Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. U.S. Supreme Court justices may have tipped their hand hearing arguments in a big patent case involving Monsanto. Should journalists be allowed to use drones to gather information? For that matter, should police? Some legislators are targeting others during gun control debate in Jefferson City. I'm Don Marsh. Our legal roundtable panel will take on these and other issues. We're happy to welcome Catherine Hanaway to our studio. She is a former Missouri House Speaker and now partner with the Ashcroft Hanaway Law Firm in St. Louis. With us, as usual, Bill Freivogel directs the SIU Journalism School in Carbondale. Mark Smith, Assistant Vice Chancellor at Washington University. He directs the Career Center there. Nice to see you all again, Catherine. Thanks for being with us once more.
Glad to be with you. Thanks,
Don.
I'd like to start with you. You had indicated that you wanted to talk about sequester. Of course, everybody is talking about the sequester these days. As a former legislator, I'm curious about using law and legislation to what appears to be manufacturing a crisis. What are your thoughts?
Well, it's very troubling, and it kind of feels like deja vu all over again. On a much smaller scale, we went through this in the Missouri House. And it happens, and when I say this, I mean sort of the fear-mongering that's going on, putting out numbers about who's going to be laid off and how many jobs are going to be lost and how directly it's going to impact services. Governor Holden kind of engaged in that when we refused to pass a tax increase. This seems to be a similar story. And, of course, the executive branch that wants the tax increase talks about the services that are going to most directly impact people. I think the thing that's important for everybody to bear in mind here, we're talking about budget cuts that are equal to between 2 and 2.5% of the total federal budget. And given the belt tightening that families and businesses have had to go through since the economic downturn and the fact that we just raised taxes in January, a 2 to 2.5% cut in the federal budget seems eminently reasonable. The bad part about it is that the president is not willing to work with the Congress to cut fat. He wants to make the case that it's going to be essential services. In fact, it seems like the most essential services. Both the Congress and the president ought to pull back and do the reasonable thing and find the waste, fraud, and abuse. And I think everybody can agree that there's 2 to 2.5% of that in the federal budget and cut that stuff instead of the things that people need, like firefighters and teachers. Mm.
Is this the proper process, though? Again, I go back to manufacturing this whole thing. I mean, clearly both sides were at work on this. The president proposed it, and the Congress did what it did to pass this legislation. And yet, what are they doing? I mean, they're just kind of policing themselves. Should legislation be used to do that sort of thing?
Well, they had to get to some agreement to deal with the debt ceiling, which is how we got all of this. I think it was a lousy deal. It was a deal that was meant to sort of be apparent to everyone involved. You know, it was supposed to be such an onerous and distasteful penalty for not getting a real deal worked out that no one would go for the deal. Well, in point of fact, we're up against it, and they still, despite having known for more than a year that they were coming up on this deadline, haven't figured out a way to resolve it. So to directly answer your question, I think it's a terrible way to make policy. An admission by all sides that they can't do it, that they would have to foist this upon themselves. And I would hope that we could get the two sides to talk to each other. You know, if the Senate would pass a bill that dealt with these cuts, I think it would have broad bipartisan support. As we know, everything that goes through the Senate has to because of the filibuster rules.
Sure.
And I think that that would be a good place for it to start. But if it doesn't, I think these cuts are going to hit on March 1st, and I'm not sure they'll get reversed.
But the impact, as I understand it, is not going to be felt immediately. It will take a little time. Bill, Mark, you want to weigh in on this?
I would just say that if you're Congress, it may not be a great idea to pass legislation that everyone describes as putting a gun to your head because maybe the guns are going to go off, and that's what's going to happen on March 1st. And, I mean, everybody said, the president said, the House Speaker says that they don't really want this sequester to go into effect the way that it's structured. It's not the way in which you should cut government. As Catherine says, you should go after waste, fraud, and abuse to the extent you can find it. And then beyond that, you got to find other things, but you don't do it with this sort of meat axe approach. So I think it's not the best way to make policy.
And Mark, do you want to?
Yeah, I agree with it. It's not a good policy. The other thing I would say is, you know, there's big chunks of things that are kind of exempt from it. So even though the cuts are around, I think, like you said, 2-2.5, for the areas where they'll fall, it's more like 8-10%. So I think that's pretty heavy-handed.
Well, as we say in radio and television, stay tuned. No one seems to think that anything is going to be hammered out between now and Friday. Agreed?
Agreed.
Is that what you're saying? Okay. Let's move on. Bill, I'll turn to you with regard to this Monsanto case. There's so much to talk about today, but this is a big one. My impression from having read about the oral arguments is that at least one justice has tipped his hand, and we may know where this thing is going before they actually do anything.
Yeah, I think it's pretty clear Monsanto's going to win. So this is a case – I mean, no one really defended the Indiana soybeans farmer.
Why don't you background it for us?
Okay, so the background is a small soybeans farmer in Indiana down in Knox County whose name is Hugh Bauman plants two crops of soybeans every year. The first crop, which is the one that's likely to grow the best, he buys Monsanto Roundup Ready seeds. He likes the seeds. They enable him not to use as much pesticide and herbicide. He can just use Roundup, and that kills all of the things that are attacking the soybeans. And he does not use the seeds from that first crop. He doesn't replant them. Then every season he has a second crop, which is a little iffier because he might, I guess, run out of the growing season. So he doesn't really want to buy the more expensive Roundup Ready seeds. So he got this notion, well, I'm going to buy the soybeans out of the local grain elevator. Now, those soybeans would have Roundup Ready characteristics, and they would also have some just commodity seed that was not genetically engineered. But Bauman suspected that the Roundup Ready characteristics would be dominant. 90% of soybeans these days are Roundup Ready seeds, and he was right. And so then for his second crop, he used the seeds from the grain elevator and then any seeds that developed from that second crop. So the question is, how far does Monsanto's patent reach after the sale of its seeds? And, Bauman was saying it shouldn't extend to those soybeans in the grain elevator. Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Breyer, who would normally be on maybe a Democratic appointee, would maybe take a more liberal approach. Both of them said, you know, why in the world would any company like Monsanto spend money to develop a seed like this when after one planting, a farmer can just replicate it and have the invention for himself? And I think that's pretty clear that Monsanto is going to win. A lot of university research centers like the University of Illinois, University of Missouri weighed in on the side of Monsanto. You know, if you're going to saying that if you let a person who buys a self-replicating technology replicate it and suddenly own it, you're going to lose people who are making inventions at universities and other places like Apple and Microsoft.
Yeah, that's one of the questions I wanted to ask is how does this extend to other areas? The whole issue, if you buy it, don't you own it? That's part
right,
of the
yeah,
argument.
That's what Bauman was saying. Sure. And there is some sort of doctrine in antitrust law, it's particularly in antitrust law, that a first sale then extinguishes the patent rights. So you like, for example, Monsanto, a company that sells something that's covered by a patent can't control the price all the way down the chain, of sale. But this is different where you have this technology that can replicate itself and, you know, suddenly the person who buys it to use it is suddenly making the new product himself without having done the research.
Sure. Well, some of the justices may have tipped their hand during the oral arguments. Another thing that I've heard mentioned is the fact that Clarence Thomas at one time was a corporate attorney for Monsanto. And people point to that, too, as potential. Is that, Mark, you look like you're ready to
comment? I don't
think
that's a big deal. I mean, that was probably, in the 70s or something that he did that? I mean, I and Catherine, you did private practice. I mean, I don't even remember some of the clients and cases I worked on, and that was only 20, 25 years ago. It just all kind of goes together. I don't think that's a big issue at all. The other thing I would say about this Monsanto case is even if Monsanto wins, they're not going to get anything. This guy, the farmer, went broke. I think he's got like $4,000 of assets. And you know, Monsanto sells these seeds saying you can plant them, but you can't plant the seeds that grow from it.
Well, so, that's exactly what right. Monsanto gets, and that's what Monsanto wants, wants, right, Catherine?
Well, and I think the part of the story that maybe isn't apparent to those of us who make our livings and make our homes in urban areas is what a David and Goliath story it is for these individual farmers. You know, this guy goes out, plants these seeds, works those fields, puts his land and his capital investment and all of his tractors and everything else at risk and at the whims of the weather, and has for probably his entire lifetime, and has a real belief that that plant, after it's grown up out of that seed, is his. Now, he's played by the rules and not, as farmers called it, brown bagged the seeds from his own crops, but he's gone to the elevator and took the chance that those soybeans had some Roundup Ready seeds among them. It really, this is a pitched battle in the agricultural community. I tend to believe that agriculture benefits more from having Monsanto and companies like it do the research and development to bring these kinds of seeds that are vastly more productive to market. But it's a very emotional argument among farming communities, and it's tough. There does have to be some point at which there's a cutoff on how far out Monsanto can carry this. And it's not just Monsanto. It's anyone who's in agribusiness. But how many generations down does it still belong to them?
Was that part of the argument, Bill? Do you recall whether that was ever brought up, how many generations of might be involved in something?
You know,
like
I didn't
this.
Read the transcript of the whole argument. In the press accounts, I didn't see that come up. As a matter of fact, they seemed to be they didn't even seem to want to deal very much with the nuance of, well, he was getting these out of the grain elevator as opposed to just taking the seeds of the first crop. So they didn't seem to have much patience for his argument. I agree with Catherine. It's sort of if I can plagiarize my wife, who wrote a column about this over the weekend, it's sort of a head-heart kind of thing when you talk to Bauman, which I did on the phone last week or the week before last. I mean, he's a very sympathetic guy, and he says he wouldn't care if Monsanto came after him as long as he was doing something wrong, but he wasn't doing anything wrong. But then on the other hand, there's the head thing, and we really need to have technological innovation is the future. And it doesn't make sense to do things that that will diminish people's intellectual property rights and cut down on innovation.
That's Bill Freivogel. He is with us as part of our Legal Roundtable panel today. Also with us in studio is Catherine Hanaway. She's a partner with the Ashcroft Hanaway Law Firm. And also with us is Mark Smith of Washington University. All attorneys, it's our Legal Roundtable. We'll continue our discussion in just a moment. And if you have questions about things we're talking about, give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet at STL on air, and you can also reach us through Facebook. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our Legal Roundtable discussion. I want to get on to an issue here that could be extensive, and that is there are a number of gun issues before the Missouri legislature, I think 12 or 13 of them. Let me just quickly go over some of them. Mark, I'm going to turn this over to you, but remember, we only have about 40 minutes.
Yeah, right, okay.
40 minutes left. Roy Ellinger, a Democrat from University City, is proposing that it be made a Class C felony to manufacture, import, possess, purchase, sell, or transfer any assault weapon, large-capacity magazines in Missouri. There is a bill to prohibit federal firearms laws to apply to guns made in Missouri if they don't leave the state. That's an interesting one. Yeah. Another House bill would bar federal officials from implementing any restrictions on semi-automatic firearms. There's a bill to authorize staff school protection officers. We've heard about that. Chief Fitch in St. Louis County is proposing something like that. Gun training for first graders in Missouri, if it passes. That's enough to chew on to start with. Where do you want to go with that?
Some of this stuff just really goofy, and some of it's just slightly goofy. And that's my legal assessment. The idea that federal laws, so there's this bill that says federal laws are not going to apply to Missouri. You just can't do that. And they're going to make it a crime for police officers to enforce any federal law that comes down. I mean, that was part of the Civil War. You know, you can't just say federal doesn't apply to me. We back out of it. So this the first grader one, the education, I don't I guess the issue – they're not going to teach kids how to shoot guns. It's a gun safety course that I guess the NRA sponsors. That doesn't sound necessarily like a terrible idea to me. It's mandated though, and I think I kind of find it strange that some of the – you know, we don't have mandated sex education, for example, which might be more important for kids to get. But, I mean, I don't think it's bad to tell a kid, if you find a gun, here's the right steps to take. And that's a safety issue.
Let me just interrupt you there. I think there's another proposal out there that's just popped up, and that is that it would require parents to notify schools, is that right, if there is a gun in the home.
Have yeah, that, that was that came out of St. Louis, I
exactly,
think. Right,
exactly.
Right.
It's Marie Chappell in the dog.
Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. Right. That seems – I think that would probably be difficult. The other one that's kind of interesting is there's a proposed tax on violent video games, and this is going to be used – I mean, a lot of this is coming out as a result of the shootings that occurred out east. And this idea was we'll use that money – for mental health issues. I think that's probably problematic because the Supreme Court has said video games are free speech. You can't tax, you know, expressions of free speech based on the content. So I think that would probably be unconstitutional to do, although it's winding its way. I doubt any of these really pass, but...
Well, there's another proposal out there, too, to make it a felony. A felony crime if a legislator proposes legislation.
Actually, I'm glad you brought that up because to me that's the most offensive of all. The idea that, you know, we've got this in the law of defamation, we've got kind of a specific exemption saying, well, we want to protect robust exchange of ideas in the legislature and in the courts. We don't. And so the idea that you can't even propose something and that's a felony, that just seems ridiculous. And these people are saying, I know it's probably not constitutional, but I want to make a statement. Well, that's fine. Make a statement, but don't introduce legislation.
That kind of brings us back to where we started this program, was, you know, with regard to using the legislative process to make statements.
Now,
Catherine,
knowing
they're not going to go anywhere.
You're the only real former legislator. What I mean, am I being too naive about this to say you shouldn't pass or propose a law that you know is just goofy?
I think you should have a little more sense of humor about
okay,
it.
Okay.
I think that's how it was intended. You know, one of the funny things that happened when I was in the legislature is after a very lengthy, probably 20-hour budget debate, someone put in an amendment that said you need to know when to hold them, know when to fold them.
that was Representative Kenny Rogers.
but this is a very serious topic, and I think that our efforts need to be aimed at what will be effective in reducing gun violence. And I think that all of those measures that were just talked about, by and large, aren't well suited to do that. And particularly those very aggressive measures that seek to ban whole categories of weapons. And we've seen what's happened is that's been proposed at state and federal levels. Sales of those weapons have skyrocketed. You can't buy an assault weapon. You can't buy a large magazine right now. Some of the things that I think we have to do that aren't happening is we need to prosecute the federal gun laws that are on the books. I know when I was the U.S. attorney here, second only to the other district in Missouri, nationwide we prosecuted more felons in possession of handguns than anywhere else. Since the new administration came in 2008, the prosecution of gun crimes is down 30%. And I'm going to risk reading a statistic here, and I admit it to the other gentleman on the panel that I don't have my glasses, so bear with me. But there were about 76,000 times that people went in to buy firearms in 2010 and were denied based on some kind of a background check. 4,700 of those, so far under 10%, were actually referred out to field offices for prosecution. Only 62 cases were brought. Hmm. Well, you know, the people who are the most dangerous are the people who already have a proven record of either mental illness or criminal problems. We need to be going after those folks and not – engaging in legislative debates that result in more gun sales.
Thoughts?
Well, it seems like, at least at the, on the national level, that there's quite a bit of support. I mean, certainly in the polls and maybe in Congress, with the exception here of the NRA's against it, of improving the background checks so that they're more comprehensive, cover gun shows, et cetera. So that seems to be a piece of legislation that might get somewhere, maybe some limitations on the size of magazines, since you know, when there are assault rifles used in these mass killings, large magazines seem to be a factor. It's interesting that in Illinois, on last week, the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the federal court of appeals that covers Illinois, decided not to review a decision of a three-judge panel of the Seventh Circuit that had thrown out Illinois' concealed weapons law. That was they decided that 5-4. So now Lisa Madigan has to decide whether or not to appeal. But the four dissenting judges said that Illinois, which has got to put together a new law over the next 180 days or the 180 days since the decision, that he made some recommendations of things that he thought clearly would be constitutional, such as so what did the lower court say? The lower court said you have a Second Amendment constitutional right. The Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals said you have a Second Amendment constitutional right to have a gun out in public. What the U.S. Supreme Court said a couple of years ago is you have a Second Amendment right to have a gun in your home to defend yourself. So the Seventh Circuit took it a step further and says you can have that gun out in public. And so Illinois' law against that was unconstitutional. Now, what these dissenting judges on the Seventh Circuit court said was Illinois, in putting together a new law, could clearly say you can't have a gun in a church, a school, place of employment, a bar. There's certain guns you couldn't have, such as assault rifles with large magazines. Maybe you need to have a cause to be able to carry a gun. New York has a law to that effect that was upheld by the Federal Court of Appeals there. And maybe you have to carry it not concealed but in plain view. So these are some suggestions that the dissenters made about how Illinois could address the task it has of putting together a new law while Lisa Madigan decides whether to appeal this to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, the gun issue is certainly not going to go away.
And we should probably mention when we had Jennifer Joyce last week talking about the gun court in St. Yeah. Louis, trying to – I think this kind of goes with what Catherine was saying, the idea that let's treat these violations of the law, let people know this is a big deal, we're going to treat it seriously, and then put the full weight of the law behind those kind of violations.
And in terms of fairness, too, I want to point out we had talked about the proposed legislation making it a felony to offer certain legislation on gun control, that a similar kind of bill on the right to work issue was also offered by a Democrat, again, making a point and trying to get that whole thing going.
That would be equally goofy.
I get the impression we're unanimous on that. Voter ID is back. It looks like there's a chance anyway that the citizens of Missouri might have to vote on a constitutional amendment on voter ID, but people are already talking about it's going to the Supreme Court. On what basis would something like that go to the Supreme Court? It's already failed. A similar bill has failed. A similar proposal has failed in the Missouri Supreme Court.
Right. Well, the Missouri Supreme Court struck down the voter ID law that was passed several years ago. So that's why there has to be a constitutional amendment passed to get past that Missouri Supreme Court decision. Now,
because it was struck down, not because of a U.S. constitutional violation, but Missouri constitutional violation.
The U.S. Supreme Court upheld Indiana's photo ID law. So on a national basis, it would seem as though it's not a violation of the U.S. Constitution to pass a voter ID law. But then in addition to passing a constitutional amendment, there would also have to be legislation to put it into effect. And I mean, from what I've read, it looks like perhaps the Republicans are a few votes short of a enough votes to override a Nixon veto. Nixon has vetoed this kind of legislation before. They need about three or four more votes to be able to override, to actually implement a voter ID. So we'll see how that – I guess that would end up being after – well, I don't know when that enabling legislation would be passed, but they may need a few more votes to get it through.
Okay. Any other points on that? We have a number of calls on some of the things we've talked about already. Let's bring a few folks in before we move on to other things. And we can begin with Jerry calling from O'Fallon. Jerry, thanks for waiting. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Hi.
Yeah, I think I've said before, it's like, you know, Dog Patch USA is back in session. It seems like there's a not only in our legislature, but among a lot of people I encounter in the public, there seems to be a belief that a constitutional right cannot be regulated, and, you know, regarding the bill proposed by making it a federal offense, and yet probably our primary constitutional right, the right to vote, everyone seems to be very, very, really is looking to regulate that even more than it already is. So I find that kind of a hypocritical type stance, but there's no shortage of that, I guess. Thank you.
All right. Anyone care to comment to Jerry's remarks?
Well, with the voter ID, the Supreme Court has said, you know, there's a state interest in ensuring that we have safe, legitimate elections. And so they've recognized a state interest in this. There hasn't been a lot of evidence, I don't think, that there is fraud, but they said that just the appearance. And this is a very important mechanism of our government, so it's okay for the states to try and safeguard it. And, you know, I think most states are trying to make it easy to get the IDs. I still think it's a bad idea. I'm not saying it's unconstitutional or anything, but I can see where people on the other side feel differently.
Let me ask you a question,
yeah.
Mark. Can a student walk around WashU without a photo ID?
Sure.
Really?
Yeah.
But doesn't the university?
They forget their ID. They're
students. But they issue one.
Yeah,
to
we
every
issue them.
Student,
right?
Because you want to know who they are and that they are entitled to be enrolled at the university. And why shouldn't with the entitlement, a right that is as important and as fundamental to our democracy, why shouldn't we want to know who the people are that are casting those ballots?
Well,
that they're entitled to do so.
Yeah, I guess the difference is.
And
from
they've
my
only
perspective,
done so
the states
once.
Are not issuing the IDs, right? I mean, the people have to go out and find a picture ID.
But the provisions have been made for those who don't have driver's licenses to be able to get them at no cost.
Right, but they're not issuing them. And I guess that it would be like me requiring students who come to my class to say, you need to show me your ID every day to come to the class. I'm not, you know.
No, it's just when you vote. You know,
well, we don't
once
do a lot
every
of
4 years
in my
for
class.
President.
Yeah, but I hear what you're saying, and I know reasonable
mind. You can't
open
a bank account. In most states, you can't get a concealed carry permit. And certainly those people who are against voter IDs are for IDs for being able to buy a firearm. It's just a very interesting dichotomy how they want to know who people are at one instance and don't want to know who they are in another.
Yeah.
I mean, the estimates are that there are several thousand people who would find this actually very difficult and might end up not voting.
When you have to go vote, I mean, you still have to give them your name. You have to sign. They check your signature. I mean, you're right. Having them show a photo ID would be would be even more secure. But I don't know that. You know, all the research I've seen says this is not a huge issue. And so what I think is a lot of people are pushing this are not as concerned about the keeping our elections safe, but they're rather trying to disenfranchise. Now, I know the people say, no, that's not what I'm doing. And so maybe I'm wrong, but that's how it kind of comes across to me. But like I said, I think reasonable minds can disagree on it. I just don't see a real compelling need for it, but that's less of a legal issue.
Voter fraud cases are very difficult to find
and
very difficult to make. I prosecuted some when I was U.S. attorney, and it was mostly registration issues, which would be a great time to have a photo ID and make it a lot easier to prevent illegal registrations. As we know, Tom Villa, who I just ran into the other night,
my neighbor,
his long-deceased father registered to vote. He didn't. I don't want to impugn Tom. Someone else, and Tom took offense at that. Jennifer Joyce, the city prosecutor, her long deceased mother was registered by someone to vote on election day this year, and I won't name the county in Missouri because I don't think the clerk did anything wrong. But a voter went and asked for a provisional ballot and was given two in succession that were pre-marked for Barack Obama. It is most definitely an issue. It is hard to collect the statistics. It's our most fundamental right. We should at least ensure that people are only able to exercise it once and not to cheat the system.
I mean, I think it's true that, that there have been cases of fraud in voter registration, the question, but there haven't been. There's very little proof of voter fraud in actual casting of ballots. And then, you know, then we have these other situations where we have people standing in lines for 3 hours to cast a vote. I mean, it just seems to me that we should encourage everyone who is eligible to be able to vote and vote in a timely fashion and then count the votes and see who wins.
Why don't we just have a national ID card like so many other countries have?
Civil libertarians, both on the right and the left,
yes,
would be nervous about that, I think.
Agreed. That's one area where the far right and the far left totally agree.
Sort of meet.
Okay. Have to take another break. That trial balloon surely didn't fly very far. It was made out of lead. All right. We'll be back in just a moment. Continue our legal roundtable discussion. We have in studio Catherine Hanaway, Mark Smith, and Bill Freivogel. We'll continue the conversation after this. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our legal roundtable panel discussion. I'm Don Marsh. With me in studio is Catherine Hanaway, partner with the Ashcroft Hanaway Law Firm, Bill Freivogel of SIU's Journalism School in Carbondale, and Mark Smith, Assistant Vice Chancellor at Washington University. Let's take a couple of calls and then move on to some other things. Jim has been waiting, so let's take his call. Jim, thanks for waiting.
Thank you for having me. My question is, could the governor or the legislature in Missouri do an end run around federal law by regulating the Missouri militia, just saying, hey, here's your assault weapons. The feds can't do a thing about it.
All right. Let's see if we can get a response to that.
I think the governor probably could give the Missouri militia assault weapons without any kind of difficulty, regardless of what the federal law is. I'm sure the federal law would have exceptions for officers of the law and official state militias and National Guard and armed forces. So
it sounded like Jim was implying that the governor is going to make us all members of the Missouri militia.
Oh, make us all. Well, I doubt if they could do that.
Like in Switzerland, where everyone has a gun in there, or in Israel, where everyone has an assault weapon in their closet ready to go.
I'd say that would be doubtful.
Probably. Another call. Andrea in South City or South County. Go ahead, Andrea.
Hi. I'm not sure if I heard this correctly on the radio, that it is currently legal for somebody to scrap a car that's over 10 years old without a title. And if that is true, that that's legal now, who does that benefit besides, car dealers and insurance companies and thieves? Because, I guess I had a false sense of security driving around in my old Toyota.
So I think this was a change in the Missouri legislature last year or a couple of years ago, and it was, as I understand it, was intended to help some people, probably more in rural areas, who had kind of junk cars on their property in the back, and they wanted to get rid of them and didn't want to have to go through all the title. But it's had a bad effect on the city, where it's now easier to sell junk older cars without a title, and so I guess there's been some pushback on that, and there's going to be an attempt to change the legislation.
Okay, I hope that answers Andrea's questions. Speaking of the legislature, once again, there is some discussion in Jefferson City about concerns that some legislators have over the potential use of drone aircraft to do certain types of surveillance, and particularly with regard to journalists using these devices. Nothing has been proposed yet, I don't believe, but this is a concern that some legislators have. Do any of you guys? Catherine?
I think it's a legitimate concern. I think the same civil libertarians that would be worried about a national registration for everyone have real concerns that, these drones, which now can be the size of a dinner plate, might be able to hover in close quarters or over your backyard. I mean, if anyone who goes on Google Earth can see how close they can get from a satellite photo. We do all want to enjoy some measure of privacy in our lives, and I think it's a real concern about how far these drones might go in terms of spying on our everyday activities.
Well, what about police use then? Journalists are one thing, police another. I mean, you have a whole probable cause situation there, do you not, in terms of tracking people or looking through their bedroom window?
I think you have real probable cause issues. I have less concern if it is a substitute for a high-speed chase.
Mm-hmm.
If the police are in pursuit, I think it might be a safe and practical way. I also think if we are in a situation where we're looking for a missing child and a way to cover a lot of ground quickly, I think that there are legitimate uses that the military and police can put drones, to which they can put drones. But I think this is a brave new world that we need to proceed into very carefully.
I think some of the concerns were from, say, farmers, for example, or owners of large, meatpacking or farm raising facilities. That concerned that some of these animal rights activists might get drones to hover over their farm or their kennel, and to try to collect information and then portray them in a bad light. So I think that's one source of this concern.
Any other thoughts with regard to that?
No, I think it's brave new world. We had that Supreme Court case that we talked about. I think it was last year the Supreme Court talked about putting a following a car with a
GPS.
GPS, and that you could tell they weren't comfortable with that. So I think we're going to see more and more of this kind of stuff going to the courts.
Let's take another call. Lynn will join us now. Lynn, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you so much for taking
the call.
John, great show. My concern is, and my question is, I feel like that the Missouri legislators have one job to do, and that is make laws that help the citizens of the state of Missouri. And it also appears that they have no compunction about wasting our time or our money with frivolous legislation. And they need to stop this. There's lots of things out here that we're concerned about and that we care about, and they waste our time and our money. We can't do this in our jobs. Why can they do this in their jobs with our time and money? Thank you so much.
Thanks for the call. Boy, legislators at all levels are really taking it for the recently and the last couple of years, aren't they? Catherine, have things changed much since your days in the legislature?
I think they have changed some, but not directly to her point. And I certainly agree with her that public servants have an obligation to do their jobs and do them well and not waste the public's resources. But I also have a very firm conservative belief that the first obligation of legislators at any level is just as the physician's oath requires, first do no harm. And so the volume of legislation isn't necessarily the best test of protecting the citizens. Sometimes it is the obligation of legislators to protect the citizens from the government. And so I never thought a high bill count was necessarily the measure of a successful session.
Maybe they could start doing that by not promoting legislation that has no chance of passage and they're just doing it to make
right.
It,
and I think
a
that's
political
what Lynn's
point.
Suggesting,
yes.
And
yeah.
I think that's a great idea.
Yeah.
I mean, the Missouri legislature just has session after session seems to think that it's a nation unto itself and can ignore what the federal government does. And it's, this is a pre-Civil War view.
Back to the phones. We'll take another call and then move on. Elizabeth in St. Louis, go ahead.
Yes, I was appalled to hear that a Missouri legislator would propose a law against gun control laws. I think that is absolute insanity. I think assault weapons should be banned immediately. They're weapons of mass destruction and have no place in a civilized society. And I just can't understand people being so lax about the whole thing. It's a horrible situation. Thank you.
Elizabeth, thanks for the call. She certainly represents one distinct side in this ongoing and volatile debate. Mark, did you want to?
Probably the minority side of Missouri, though. I mean, so I wouldn't hold my breath for that kind of legislation passing in Missouri.
Any other thoughts? Pretty much in lockstep on that. Okay, I want to play something for you now as time begins to wind down a little bit. Get your headsets on and listen carefully for a few seconds.
Riley Squirrel, Riley Squirrel. Hey, Cardinal fans, there goes the Riley Squirrel. Riley Squirrel, Riley Squirrel. That funny, fuzzy, frisky Riley Squirrel.
St. Louis artist Randy Mayfield and the Rally Squirrel. Is there anyone here who has forgotten about the Rally Squirrel? We all remember it. 2011 postseason, this little critter came scooting out from the stands or someplace and all of a sudden was on all the T-shirts and just all over the place. However, there's been, since that time, there's been a trademark dispute that's been going on. And I have, just want to look at my notes here because people are saying there's an outfit in Fenton, I guess, that was using this for T-shirts and what have you, memorabilia. Mm-hmm. Cardinals and Major League Baseball have challenged that, saying they should not have the right to register this as a trademark. But one of the arguments is that this was an incident that just happened. No one made it happen. So therefore, virtually anybody would have the right to claim a trademark. What do you think?
I think it's tough to get trademarked the Rally Squirrel because it seemed to have just kind of emerged during these games, and I think what I saw, the application for the trademark was well after both of these games, and you know, when you're trying to get a trademark, you want a unique and kind of novel expression, and they're supposed to be strict about granting them. So this to me doesn't seem to fit within what one could trademark. And the Cardinals are fighting their application.
And Major League Baseball. I mean, this is not just an isolated case, apparently.
I'd be surprised if they get a trademark on the Rally Squirrel.
So the fellow in Fenton says he's the first one who used the Rally Squirrel on a T-shirt. The Cardinals, I think, contest that. I mean, it's sort of a key question, I think, is, so what do you think about when you think about the Rally Squirrel? You think about the Cardinals more than you do anything else. So I think the Cardinals probably have they may be the big guy in this fight, but I think they have a pretty good case.
So there's not a first-come, first-serve element to
it. Not a first-come, first-serve, necessarily.
But my understanding is that there has been a settlement. It's not been announced yet, or they're very close to one. So we that's the understanding.
Well, the other thing is, I mean, is anyone still buying Rally Squirrel stuff? I mean, this is kind of like buying, you know, something from, I don't know, just it's out of date, you know.
I love the entrepreneurial spirit of the guy in Fenton, and he's gone for it. And if he's got a settlement from the Cardinals, bully for him.
Yeah, right.
I'm glad baseball's almost here.
As a matter of fact, I wish I had done it. If he's going to get a settlement from the Cardinals in Major League Baseball, here.
So who has the copyright to that music
you
just played?
Yeah.
Right.
Randy
there
Mayfield, I don't know. I think we got it off of YouTube, actually, which creates another situation, does it not? Okay, so much for the Rally Squirrel. In the time we have left, a couple of other issues we might be able to explore somewhat. One concerns the settlement between the St. Louis Archdiocese and St. Stanislaus. This is a dispute that's been going on over property and assets for a good many years, but the Archdiocese has basically said enough already.
Right.
What's going on here? Does anybody have any particular insight?
Well, I don't think we know because most of the settlement was confidential. So I think the only things made public were St. Stanislaus agrees not to represent themselves as a Catholic church, and they both agreed we're not going to pay each other money. But the rest was confidential. I mean, I think, you know, reading between the lines, I assume the big issue was who keeps all the property. And it's, you know, the decision that came out in the circuit court, last year, gave it all to St. Stanislaus. So I think they'll probably keep their property. And the Catholic Church is just walking away.
So nothing's changed.
Right. I don't think anything's changed.
It would be interesting to know why the Archdiocese pulled back on that. I wonder if the expense of just continuing this thing is
I don't know that it was a public relations good thing for them. Mm-hmm. You know, they seem kind of heavy-handed on this little church.
Which is sort of interesting because the Archbishop had said he was going to appeal it all the way to the Supreme Court.
Exactly.
You know, my own look, just from looking at the decision very quickly, it seems to me that the Archdiocese actually could potentially have had a good case. I mean, the judge in this case had interpreted Catholic canon law.
Right.
I mean, that's really not the job of a court, a district, I guess in this case a state court.
Yeah.
So I think they had a decent argument. So it is interesting that they have decided to settle.
I think the Archdiocese did a very good thing here that is good for public relations. I think it also sends a good message that the church is something beyond the building, that this is a piece of property, and they're happy to give the property to these private citizens, but they can't claim to be a part of the church. To me, it is a rare good decision, and I am a practicing, proud, devout Catholic. We've had a lot of missteps in the church for a number of years, and I think that this was a very good decision by the church to say, let's get it over with, put it behind us, and that our faith and our beliefs are something very distinct from the building, and we should not expend any more effort over property rights.
Okay, we have a little time left to go back to the phones and bring some folks into the conversation once again. And we'll bring in Jay this time, calling from Normandy. Go ahead, Jay.
Yeah, hi. So this would be directed to Ms. Hanaway, since she was in the legislature. First of all, I don't understand how these representatives are passing or trying to refight the Civil War. And I'm a natural Republican, but back to the Danforth or perhaps even Goldwater, and those guys would be embarrassed by this kind of stuff. And to say that a 30-round or a limitation on a magazine isn't helpful, I just don't understand that. I'm a former law enforcement officer, and I don't want to be. I wouldn't want to be outgunned on the streets, and that's what's going on. And to worry about the reaction of a bunch of gun nuts rushing out to gun stores, which, by the way, ought to be more regulated. Perhaps we can regulate ammunition, but I mean, let's just not worry about it. It's just crazy. Less, more guns and more lethal guns kill people. You can read about it last week in Las Vegas or Los Angeles, are the 31-year-old deputy in Washington County, Missouri. These guns have the ability to outreach and get people and kill them, and kill LEOs. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Catherine?
Well, it's hard to take responsibility for everything that the legislature does. But I will speak specifically to the Second Amendment and the fact that it is a very much treasured and valued amendment among the vast majority of Missourians, and I think that legislators are reflecting those views in the legislation they have proposed. I think that there needs to be a dialogue between those who are concerned about gun safety and therefore propose bans on guns or on ammunition or on clips, and those who care about gun safety but very much care about their Second Amendment rights. I think that gun owners and gun opponents have in common that they care about gun safety, and we're having the wrong dialogue, and we're getting too divided, with each side getting extremely dug in, those who oppose gun rights wanting gross expansions of existing law, and those who are pro-gun rights digging in even further than before. We need to get in and, as I said before, have a dialogue about what is actually going to prevent death and killing. And I don't think we're having a well-informed dialogue around that. I think we're having a lot of emotion. And to be perfectly clear, I am a supporter of the Second Amendment, and I think that gun owners are the ones who are involved in safety courses and who care about not only that they have their rights, but that they take responsibility for their rights, and are the ones lawful, law-abiding citizens are the ones who are preventing guns from getting out into the population and into the hands of those who would do wrong with them.
We only have a few seconds left. In any sense, is the tail wagging the dog on this issue? 80% of the people in this country, as I understand, don't own guns and aren't involved in this debate.
Well, I don't know. I mean, we have to, just because it's a smaller percentage of people who have guns, I mean, I think we have to respect their rights. There is a Second Amendment right to bear arms. The Supreme Court says that means you get to have a gun in your home to protect yourself from intruders, but some of the claims of like an absolute, you know, broad for Second Amendment right are very exaggerated.
We got to leave it at that. I'm afraid we're out of time. Thank you so much for being with us, Mark, Catherine, and Bill. Good to see you again. We'll get together again in about a month. Tomorrow in St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk with Bruce Feiler about his new book offering strategies for improving dynamics in contemporary families. Archive versions of the program available for download or podcast at sdlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.